Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel of the New Books Network podcast. This is Madhumanti, and today I'll be talking to Professor Harry van der Hulst, a professor of linguistics at the University of Connecticut. And we'll be talking about his book, A Mind for Language, An Introduction to the Innateness Debate, published in 2023 by the Cambridge University Press. Hello and welcome, Professor van der Hulst. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so today we'll be talking about your book, A Mind for Language, An Introduction to the Innateness Debate. So if we can start with the very title and the words we see in the title, could you tell us a little bit about what is the innateness debate and how does it relate to language and the human mind?
Okay, yeah. So linguists have long concluded that it is actually a miracle that young children learn language so fast. In just a couple of years, children become fluent speakers, barring medical conditions, of course. They don't get formal instruction in language. They are being spoken to, obviously. And linguists, under the influence of famous linguist Noam Chomsky, have come to agree that it is really a mystery how children do it and why they do it so fast. For Chomsky, this led to the idea that perhaps children come to our world prepared to learn human language. They have, so to speak, and that's the title of the book, A Mind for Language. They come prepared with something in their minds that instructs them, guides them to go from the language utterances that they hear to constructing in their minds a grammar for the language that they are exposed to. So this brings us to the term innateness debate. The way that Chomsky put it was children, humans, but children have an innate capacity for language, to acquire language. So that doesn't mean that they come equipped with the full language, because then all humans would speak the same language. They come equipped with a, almost, you could say, a mental instruction manual to process the languages, the language utterances that they hear, and then extract the grammatical rules, the rules about the sound structure, the meaning, and thus, you know, in a few years become, you know, fluent speakers of the language. So there is debate about that, because there are many linguists and psychologists and philosophers who would argue that children can do this because humans in general have very powerful learning capacities that they apply to everything that they are exposed to, and also language. So the debate here is whether there is an innate capacity that is specific to language, and or not. So that's the debate. And what I do in the book is I go through the various arguments that linguistics has produced to support this what we call the innateness hypothesis for language, but also I give room to people who argue against it. So basically, I'm not trying to sell a particular point of view. I'm trying to, as I put it, educate the reader to become an informed participant in this debate. And then another aspect of the way that I present this is I question how do children acquire language, and is there a role for innateness? And of course, there is a role for the input that they get. I point out that this is actually an instance of the infamous nature-nurture debate. And that debate has been around for a long time, forever, and it can be applied to all sorts of other capacities of humans. We can talk about that later if you want. So when I teach using this book, I say the big topic is actually that nature-nurture debate, but to make it concrete, and because I'm a linguist, we will use language as a case study for this particular debate. So you could say we are talking about the nature and nurture of language. I think that that's a fair characterization of the book. There are a number of arguments that could be made that I did not have room in this book to discuss. So there is going to be a sequel volume where I discuss additional further arguments and always showing the pro and the con of this Chomskyan idea that there is an innate capacity for language. Is that?
I see. Yes. Yep. Yes. So let's actually talk about some of the things that you mentioned. You mentioned that this nature-nurture debate basically goes back a long time in history. And you also mentioned that this also extends outside of the purview of language and linguistics to other areas of human cognition and human behavior. So if you could elaborate on those points.
Yeah. Indeed. So this nature-nurture debate is has a long history. And in fact, the way I have a chapter in the book where I trace it back to the earliest philosophical works by Greek philosophers, we often go back to Greek philosophers, where one could say that, for example, the philosopher Plato was on the side of the role of nature, that human knowledge, he wasn't just talking about language, he was talking about how do people come to know what they know in general. And according to Plato, people know a lot, maybe everything, even, you know, from scratch, from birth. His star pupil, Aristotle, didn't buy into that idea. And so Aristotle was on the side of nurture. Aristotle said that, you know, humans acquire knowledge based on experience. They are exposed through their senses, seeing, hearing, feeling, and, or, you know, touching, and all that gives information to humans from birth. And given, he admitted that, given that humans have innate, very general learning capacities, that would be sufficient to explain how humans come to know what they know, how they come to know how to behave. So the debate starts, you could say, with the Greek philosophers, and in other philosophical traditions, we find as far back to the earliest writings that this issue has come up. And then through the millennia, this issue keeps being discussed. So in some sense, when you look at the history of linguistics, or maybe psychology, especially in the United States, there was a period in the 20th century that a lot of emphasis was put on the nurture side of how people learn things, including language. And then in the 50s, 60s, Noam Chomsky pushed back on that and put that idea on the table that when it comes to language, it is almost, in his view, it was almost impossible to understand how children learn language without proper instruction, unless they come equipped with sort of mental instructions So there is a long line of this debate with instances in other fields than linguistics. Obviously, people have asked questions about our mathematical knowledge. Is there, do humans have a math instinct? If you go to Amazon and you Google instinct, you find a whole list of books that have been written over the last couple of decades where people ask, often they then refer to instincts, where instinct stands for, you know, innate knowledge, innate information about how to behave. And there are multiple books about whether people's moral sense has an innate basis, whether parenting has an innate basis, whether our mathematical skills have an innate basis. So people have asked this question, sometimes stimulated by how Chomsky put it on the table for language. And there is also a very readable and famous book called The Language Instinct by linguist Steven Pinker. So yeah, it's general. It goes back far in time, as far as we can see, actually, from the written record. And if we shift to our contemporary situation, the nature-nurture debate comes up a lot. I tend to say that there isn't a week that will go by without an article appearing somewhere, a book even. So some people find the debate stale, and they say, you know, maybe we shouldn't continue debating it, or they feel maybe that there is a way out of this debate. But it doesn't seem to end, and it goes on, and people keep being interested in it. And one point that I'm trying to make with the book is also that it isn't, in fact, a debate that is just about language, even though I use that as a case study. It is a very general debate. And when I talk about this material to students, I give them examples of how this debate comes up in daily life, even at that age of student age, but certainly later also in life. It comes up a lot. So it is good to be informed about that. And a lot of the pro and con arguments that I discuss with respect to language can can be extrapolated to other fields as well. So in that sense, people don't only become informed about the nature-nurture debate in language, but actually about the nature-nurture debate in general. Is that
right? Okay. So we will zoom in on like the language aspect of the innateness debate, but if we could like just briefly, because you mentioned the different sides of this debate, if we could briefly talk about what will the arguments look like for language acquisition from the different sides of this debate. So what would be, so you mentioned about like Chomsky's ideas about language learning and how he says it's a complete wonder. So what will the explanation for that be from the other side of the debate?
Yeah, so Chomsky himself emphasized a particular argument that came to be known as the poverty of the stimulus argument. What does that mean? Chomsky had decent, deep knowledge of language structure. And he was, of course, not the only one, but it is important that we mention the fact that the question about how do children learn language has to take into account actually how complex language is, how complex the knowledge is that children seem to have when they become, you know, fluent speakers. So the poverty of the stimulus argument is that here stimulus means the input that children get, the sentences that are spoken to them, that's the input. And Chomsky referred to that input as poor, meaning that you know, if the input was supposed to be contain all the information that children need to learn language, you wouldn't have to postulate an innate capacity. But he showed, and other people have confirmed, that languages have such intricate properties not only in terms of their sentence structure, which is what Chomsky worked on mostly, but also in other aspects, the semantic, the meaning structure, the phonological or sound structure. There is a lot of things that you need to know in order to be a speaker that is not at all so clear or so easy to extract from just being exposed to sentences. Sentences have a rich structure and hierarchical structure. What you hear as input, what children hear, is just a stream of sound. The first problem is, how do children actually divide that stream of sound into words? How do they divide the words into speech sounds? How do they figure out what these words mean? How do they figure out how the words relate to each other in what we call the syntactic structure? So when, prior to Chomsky, in psychology, in a form of psychology that was called behaviorism, people made claims. Behaviorists made claims how our children can learn language in a trial and error process. But it has to be said that, not that these people didn't know what they were doing, perhaps, but that the knowledge of language specifically that these people had was simply not sufficient to even address this question. It's very tempting to say that children learn words because there is a cat coming into the room, they say cat, and the parent says, that's good, that's good. So they learn the word cat. And that children in that, and if they would say dog, then the parents would say, no, that's not right. It's very tempting, perhaps, to think that languages are learned in that way, trial and error, with correction. But that's just not how it works, and language is just too complex for that. And then there are additional arguments that suggest that children actually have the capacity to almost, one could say, create the language that they are speaking. They infer from the input things, obviously, because without input, a child will not start speaking. We can talk about that. There are sad examples of that. But the child is constructing the language in their mind based on the stimulus that, according to Chomsky, is poor, and the structure that they create in their mind, which we call a mental grammar, is rich and in structure is complex, actually. And again, it seems like there has to be a bridge between the stimulus that the child receives and the rich knowledge that is formed by the child. So, and as I said, there are additional arguments. There is something that is called the critical period for learning, which maybe you have a question about later. We can come back to that. But here's the core, this poverty of the stimulus idea, that children don't get instructed to language. Parents don't even know what the rules of language are. The knowledge that people have of the rules of language, unless they are linguists, they may know a little more. Knowledge that people have is very shallow and often even wrong. So parents, they may think they correct their children sometimes. Some linguists who study language acquisition would argue that correction actually has very little impact. So basically, these kids do it on their own. And they do it based on input that is just not perfect. And nevertheless, they become by definition, they become perfect speakers of the language.
Right. So we will come back to the poverty of stimulus arguments and discuss them in more detail. But before that, let's try to understand the notion of mental grammar a little better, so that maybe we can also understand the poverty of stimulus arguments better. So what is the nature of this mental grammar? What is mental grammar? Is it some sort of a general computational efficiency that humans come with, or is it more like actual rules or principles that are specific to human linguistic competence and performance? So how do we actually structure it? So you discuss this in a lot of detail in chapter 6. So if we could talk about that.
Yeah, so it is, you can think of it as a grammar. So if you try to learn a language later in life, you buy a grammar book or you are in a class that uses a grammar book, and the grammar book will inform you What are the sounds of the language? It often starts that way. What are the sounds of the language? Sometimes in conjunction with how things are being spelled. But spelling is, while very important, not an intrinsic part of that mental grammar. But you have to know what are the sounds of language, what we call the phonemes. You have to know how those phonemes can occur in combination to actually give you a word that is well formed, because not every combination of the vowels and the consonants that are relevant for a language form a combination that is actually a possible word. So there are units that have to be learned, like phonemes. There are rules that have to be learned, how they combine. And this applies at all three levels of words and sentences. Words have a sound structure, words have a meaning structure, and words have what we call a labeling, that is to say, words are nouns or verbs or adjectives. And the same applies to sentences. I mean, that's how I explain it in that chapter six, that sentences also have three layers. There is a sound structure, there is a meaning structure, and there is a structure that uses those word labels like noun and verb to construct a syntactic structure. So for all three of these layers, there are units that are like the basis, and then there are combinatorial rules that tell you how they can be combined. And sometimes there are also rules that make further modifications when words are combined. So yeah, it is, well, people call it a computational system, but it is a system of units and rules, combinatory rules. And that is, in fact, also, if you have a decent or good or extensive grammar book when you learn a language, you also hope to find what are the phonemes, what are the sounds. Implicitly, you learn what the well-formed combinations are of these phonemes by being confronted with only words that are actually well-formed. You learn things about word structure. That what we mean here is that sometimes words consist of different parts that have their own meaning, like readable consists of read and able. So all languages have rules that allow you to add words to the inventory using these what we call affixes, like able or re-read. Again, there are rules there. There are constraints because you can't just combine these units in any way you like. Then you move up to the sentence. Words are the basic units there. They have to be combined into larger units that we call phrases and sentences. So yeah, the mental grammar is a rich system with different, what we call modules, different parts. And to bring it down to its essentials, there has to be a sub-module that is about the sound structure. There has to be a sub-module that is about the meaning structure. And then there is a sub-module that is about the what we call the syntax, the way that word labels like noun, verb, adjective, preposition are being combined. So yes, you can think of it as a computational system in the sense that there are rules that combine these units in a specific way. And obviously when linguists model the mental grammar, because we actually can't observe it directly, they try to make that system as elegant and concise as possible. But yeah, think of it as a grammar book that sits inside your head. But when a child starts with language, the grammar book is largely empty. You can think of it as a workbook, like when you go to a class and you get a workbook and some information in that workbook is already specified. But as you listen to the professor, you have to add information to it. So that's another way to think of that innate system as a workbook that has information pre-specified in it, and then the learner, the child, being exposed to a language, could be multiple, has to complete that workbook and turn it into a complete grammar, and that's what we then call the mental grammar.
Mm-hmm. So what is the nature of those instructions that already exist in that workbook? So essentially, what is contained already contained within that that innate capacity that we come with. Also from the perspective of, so you talk about universal grammar, which is some aspect of mental grammar, a specific cognitive module that's shared by speakers of all languages. But then there are thousands of languages, and when we look at them from the surface, they seem to be very different from one another. They also tend to show a lot of variation in their properties and in their grammar. So how do we reconcile the ideas of universal grammar or the instructions that are already there in the workbook and the variation that we see in the grammars of different languages?
Yeah, so good question. So yeah, Chomsky came to refer to that innate system as universal grammar, UG. It's a bit of a medieval name. It could also be misleading because it could suggest that it's the grammar that covers all the languages, mm-hmm. so that children don't have to learn anything. But as I said, if the innate capacity would be a fully specified mental grammar already, then all people would speak the same language, which is not the case. So that innate system is, you could say, underspecified. It doesn't tell the child everything about the language that she is exposed to. But it one way that people have also put it is that perhaps that innate manual specifies a set of expectations about what the child could expect with respect to how languages are structured. So, for example, the fact that words consist of smaller building blocks that we call phonemes could be one of those expectations. The fact that when children hear an utterance that parents speak to them, that it is actually something that has to be broken down in smaller parts called words. The idea that these words are not just a linear string of information unit, but these words enter into an hierarchical structure. And that's important because sometimes you could have a sentence that has a certain string of words, like, you know, I hit the man with the stick. Well, that sentence could actually mean two things. It could mean that the man had a stick and I hit him, or it could mean that I hit the man with a stick. Maybe not a friendly sentence, but sentences that, you know, apparently have the same string of words can have different, what we call syntactic structures, which then reflect different meanings. Well, these are things that may not be obvious to a child, and the child comes to language with expectations. Sometimes they're called principles of language that would apply to all languages that the child doesn't have to figure out for herself. But then, as you were indicating, obviously we have a lot of different languages, and you know, people say that even today there may be some 7,000 languages around, many of which are endangered. That's a whole other thing that we could talk about. So how does the idea of universal grammar explain the fact that there are so many differences between languages? Well, here was another idea that came up in the discussion since the 60s and 70s, is that innate manual, it could stipulate what are called principles, things that hold true for all languages, that in all languages, words are organized into a hierarchical syntactic structure, that in all languages, words are composed of these things called phonemes. But then there's variation, but it is not the case that languages vary from each other without limits. So that's a thing that linguists had to figure out by comparing languages. There seem to be limitations on the diversity. So here was another idea that came up, that in that innate manual, there could be choices that a child has to make. Whether when you combine a verb with an object, like drink water, whether the order is I drink water, or whether the order is I water drink, and languages differ in that way. So the idea was that this innate grammar could consist, in addition to those principles that hold true for all languages, choices, and these were called parameters. So the choice would be out there for the child, like if you have a verb and an object, the order could be verb-object or object-verb, and the child would then decide for the language that she is exposed to, which order applies to that language. So you can almost think of those parameters as multiple choice questions. So now, all that being said, there is, of course, the question, what are all these parameters? How many are there? What are the principles? How many are there? And this idea of innateness has been around for, you know, since the late 50s, 1960s, and that is a long time, you know, 60, 70 years. And obviously, or perhaps not obvious, but we're talking about a science, so things are never static. So ideas evolve and develop. And there is discussion among linguists about, is this a parameter? Is this a principle? And I will say that Chomsky himself has changed his mind over the last 60 years considerably. Initially, his idea was that this universal grammar is a very rich in structure, has a lot of information in it. And over the years, he has come to reduce what he thinks is in there. And so currently, his idea is that perhaps one of the most fundamental principles of that system is that when we form sentences, there are mechanisms to put one sentence into another sentence, like I saw that Mary fell. And this trick, which is called recursion, can be applied again and again. John told me that he heard that Mary fell. So in principle, you can put sentence in sentence in sentence, and that gives rise to language having the flavor of infinity. There is no longer a sentence. You could go on and on. It might become unclear for whoever you are speaking to or even in your own mind. But in principle, there is this trick that allows, and in particular, this has been applied to the structure of sentences, the syntactic structure. There is this trick to, while having finite means, just a bunch of words and rules, the output, the possibilities are infinite. So what I'm saying is there, so when you ask, so what's in that UG? Well, to some extent, that depends on who you talk to. And it also depends on whether you talk to that person when he was young or when he was, you know, later in his career. It's an ongoing debate. It's not just a debate between the let's say, proponents of an innate aspect for language as opposed to people who say it's all general learning. But even within the innateness camp, you could say there is debate about how rich is that system. And there is a certain trend, as I indicated, toward minimizing what we actually have to put in there. And perhaps with that, there is a lot of discussion going on how aspects of language, aspects of that mental grammar could be the result of other factors. And indeed, there is a convergence between the proponents of general learning capacities and the proponents of innateness, because I think the proponents of innateness have come on board with the idea that language is constructed, the mental grammar, also using general learning capacities that may go beyond language as such. So I try to answer the question sort of in general terms. There are principles, there's parameters, but there is a lot of debate going on in the linguistic field.
Okay, so moving on to some of the other issues that you mentioned in the later chapters. So in chapter 11, you talk about critical period effects in language acquisition. So what are critical period effects? So is it important to receive input of a particular language within a certain age or within a certain time of your life in order to gain native-like skills? And what happens if you do not get any language input within a certain age?
Yeah, that's a very interesting and much debated part of this innateness debate. There is the observation that I mentioned earlier on that children acquire this mental grammar, their ability to be a language user in a few years. And it's all children are, again, barring medical conditions, all children are equally good at it. So Somebody once compared it to growing hair. You know, all people, babies grow hair and they don't have to put any specific effort in it. They don't do it because their parents have hair. But, you know, it's a spontaneous biological process of maturation. So then there is a second observation that if later in life, if you are an adult or even past puberty, when, you know, we enter adulthood, learning a new language seems to be a little harder. It doesn't seem to be the case that learning a later language is equally effortless. And so, but that has led to people saying that maybe there is a critical period for language. And the notion of critical period is very common in the animal kingdom at large. There are lots of examples where other animal species learn a certain type of behavior, or will show a certain type of behavior, but only if they have been exposed to certain triggers within a certain time frame. If the trigger comes too late, they don't seem to be able to display that behavior, or not perfectly. So this contrast between first language acquisition and later language acquisition has led to the idea that perhaps there is a critical period for building up a language, that children have to be exposed to input, you know, from day one, if possible, for a certain period, and then they can do it. But if the input comes too late, let's say after puberty, but there's even evidence that even earlier input can be marked as late, then learning is less perfect, and there may be differences in terms of the learning of the sound system or the syntactic system. But so, yeah, there is seems to be a critical period. And if that is true, then that suggests that there is an innate capacity for language, that is a part of our biology. And again, making the comparison with the same kind of effects elsewhere in the animal kingdom, where you know, people who study animal behavior have long concluded that if there is such an effect, then we have to assume that there is an innate piece of information that has to be triggered within a certain time frame. People have observed this with respect to bird song in particular. And so the problem is, I mean, if we learn language later in life, maybe the circumstances are not always precisely the way they are when we learn language early in life, because but be that as it may, I mean, I'm Dutch originally, so Dutch is my language, and I started learning English in high school in the Netherlands. Then I moved to the States, and I've been, you know, I use English on a daily basis, but nevertheless, I make grammatical mistakes sometimes, systematically, and my own children will point that out to me. After all these years of using English in daily life, there are certain aspects. I mean, think about my pronunciation of the sounds. I speak with an accent, as people say. So, yeah, there seems to be, I mean, a child, sometimes people say, if a young child is adopted in a country where there is another language, they will pick up that new language, and they're not going to speak that language with an accent, even if they're natural parents, or in a case of just migration of a whole family. So there seems to be something about that learning a language later in life can leave certain traces in the ability. And of course, that can differ from between individuals. Some people will be more persistent and others work harder on it. But yes, this critical period effect exists, and people are debating how long is that critical period, when does the innate system start shutting down, so to speak. There's debate about that, and as I said, it could differ with respect to which part of grammar we talk about, the sound structure, etc. But so that I think generally is taken to be a solid point for assuming that there is indeed, you know, part of our genetic makeup gives rise to neural structures in the brain that facilitate the process of acquisition. And, you know, in the normal case, so to speak, but because, of course, our world has changed a lot. But when you go back, you know, many millennia, it was people would grow up in one language, and that so 5-6 years is kind of sufficient. So why would the brain hang on to circuitry that is no longer used, can be used for something else? So it makes a certain amount of sense that there is a critical period.
Okay, so we discussed the acquisition of a second language after a certain stage in life. You also discuss in your book some very unfortunate cases, actually, of late acquisition or situations where there was no input received for any language whatsoever until a certain stage in life. So what happens if first language acquisition is to happen late?
Yeah, so it is indeed the case that if a child is not exposed to language early on and for a certain period of time, is extremely detrimental. I mean, that language doesn't bubble up spontaneously. So that is a fact. So it's not that language is completely innate. I mean, some other animal species, whatever communication system they use, it's there kind of from the start. There may be a little bit of development, but in other species, one could actually argue that whatever communication system they have, the ability to have that is completely innate, but not for humans. So we need that nurture. And if it doesn't come, language doesn't come. And if the input would only come so late that one is past that critical period, language may never come or never come in a complete way. And yeah, there are indeed sad cases in every class, in every textbook that deals with language acquisition. There is this famous case of a young girl that came to be known as Jeannie. And this is a very tragic case. An evil father prevented her from having language input for until she was like 13, when she was actually by accident was discovered. She had hardly any language, a few words. And for many years after that, she was on the one hand an object of study, and on the other hand, she was somebody who needed rehabilitation. And so linguists worked with her, psychologist, and it would seem that her language ability never, whatever ability was left, or however she was exposed to input, she didn't become fluent by any measure, and her sentences were short and didn't show like the kind of syntactic structure that we normally would expect. So, there are more tragic cases like that than you would want. There on the internet, you can find other examples of this kind of language deprivation. And a special case that I would mention is that if children are born deaf, and you know only like around 5% of deaf children who are born deaf actually have a deaf parent. So many deaf children are born in hearing families, and it can then happen, despite the best efforts of parents, that children, those deaf children, don't get sign language input for some time, and that. Even in a much shorter period of time, like 2 or 3 years, can already be bad in the sense that the ability to use sign language might not be perfect in all aspects of the grammar. There's a lot of case studies on that. So what this actually shows is that it's very important if children are born deaf and parents want to acknowledge that the children get sign language input as quickly as possible. And parents might actually, you know, quickly learn some sign language, and that already helps. And here's another remarkable fact, because then when children like that are exposed to signing that is not perfect, because parents have just learned some of it, deaf children actually go beyond what the input that they get, which is another indication that they have internal instructions to how to build up the grammar, in this case for a sign language.
Yeah, so let's talk a little more about that. So you also discuss this in chapter 12, where you talk about children going beyond the input that they receive, both from the perspective of sign language and from the perspective of Creoles, like spoken language and sign language both. So could you tell us a little bit about that argument that people like,
and it has a convincing ring to it, that there are these types of languages that have come to be called pidgin languages. So when people who speak different languages are kind of thrown together in a situation, a longer time situation, they want to communicate with each other. And what they then do is they develop a makeshift language. They combine aspects of their own languages, and we call that a pidgin. Historically, this would happen a lot in the colonial periods, where enslaved individuals were working in places for longer periods of time, and often these people had different language backgrounds, and so these things that we call pidgins would develop. And it's already remarkable that people can do that, so it actually indicates that even adults have some sort of capacity to construct maybe a simplified communication system. But then there was this remarkable discovery that if such people who speak a pidgin with each other actually form a couple and get children, the child might just be exposed to that pidgin. So then the question is the child going to simply repeat the pidgin form and mimic what the parents say? And there is this claim that no, children go beyond the input that they get. They construct a form of language that we now call a Creole language that is richer in grammatical structure. And then the question is, where does that grammatical structure come from? Well, the nativist would say it comes from that innate system that drives the child to construct that. Now, I keep saying, because when I discuss these arguments, I also discuss criticism. I also discuss people who say, well, yeah, there could be a role for children, but on the other hand, if a pidgin is used, you know, for a long period of time, then even adults would contribute to making it richer. So as with all the arguments, and that's why I say the book is an education to being a part of that discussion, right? So I'm not pushing the innateness hypothesis. Mm-hmm. I don't have a grand new theory about it. It's a book. It's a textbook, and I use it to educate people, to help people become a participant in that debate.
Right. Yeah, all this is fascinating. So sort of to end where we started from, so to go back to where we started from, we started with the idea that this innate linguistic capacity is a defining aspect of our human nature, of our humanity. It's a central aspect of our human mind, is that it allows us to have language. That is something you say in the book. So if this capacity is a major factor that helps distinguish human species from other species or other animals, then can we think of specific reasons why humans possess this and not other animals? Because animals also have communication systems. So how are those different from human language? And what could be the reason that only humans possess this sort of a capacity?
Yeah. So it is important to emphasize that all animal species have some sort of communication system, and some of those communication systems can be quite sophisticated. So we're not talking about certain things being simple, other things being complex. I mean, true, human language has a great deal of complexity. Nobody is going to deny that. But here is a thing that has long been established, and you know, this goes back to folklore and stories that people would tell about other animals learning human language. Well, people have tried it. You know, can we teach chimpanzees or dolphins or other animals? Can we teach them human language? And you can use the animals that you think are the most smart, sophisticated. I mean, chimpanzees are not that different from us anyway. So the bottom line is they can't do it. I mean, a chimpanzee can learn Well, at some point, people switched from spoken language to sign language because they thought, well, chimps can't do it because their articulatory apparatus is not evolved in the right way for that. So we switched to sign language. But so, you know, animals, chimps, even dogs, I mean, dogs in particular, can learn human words, so to speak, can learn how to respond somewhat appropriately to a spoken or signed words. Chimpanzees can use signs, perhaps, in a way, but it has long been established that what they can do with these signs is doesn't come close, you know, to what even a two-year-old child can do. So they, you could say, my book is called A Mind for Language, you could say they don't have a mind for language. If we mean language, human language, right? Because people use that term also in general for any communication system. But if we say human language, they don't have a mind for human language. They have a mind for some other communication system that we cannot learn. We can study it, but we can't use it. So, you know, you could say every species gets the communication system that they deserve or need. And that brings me to your question, why would this specific system that we call human language have evolved in our species, in our ancestors? And of course, again, this is a much debated question because we call that the question of language evolution, which I talk more about a lot in the sequel book. So readers would have to wait for that. It's probably coming out end of this year. So much debated topic because people always want to know where they come from. And is this feature of language that we find so defining for our species, you know, when did it start? Well, it's very difficult because it certainly started long before there was writing. And, you know, as people say, words don't fossilize, so you can't dig them up and see when people started using them for the first time. So it's a very much debated question, but it probably, so there's two camps, actually. Some people say, actually, Chomsky would say that what evolved for humans was just a fluke. It just happened. Some neural connection, some mutation created a neural circuitry that gave rise to this recursion property. And that, so some people say it was just a fluke, but other people are different. They say, well, usually in evolution, what we see is that species develop traits and behaviors that contribute to their ways of dealing with the environments, that the specific environment that they are exposed to. So it could be that our earliest ancestors benefited from collaboration. And one could argue that language is an important feature of successful collaboration. It's not watertight because there are other species that collaborate to find prey or to hunt. But I would say that, and it's probably too big of an issue. So maybe next year we have to talk about this again when that sequel book comes out.
Yes, of course.
This is a small commercial for that book because it is very interesting and people can't let it go. But it has to have something to do with particular needs that arose in the way our earliest ancestors lived, collaborated, etc. So in that sense, other species have communication systems that serve them well, given the challenges that the environment poses for them. So it's a very interesting subject, and there are also regularly books that appear on this issue of language evolution. Many people want to put in their two cents, as do I in that sequel book, but it's very complex because essentially there is a lack of data. Language emerged long ago before a written record. And so how can you scientifically speak about the emergence of a capacity if you don't have direct data? And so people appeal to what we call circumstantial data, but it's a whole further discussion that we probably don't have time for today.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was great talking to you, and we'll definitely wait for the sequel book now. So it was great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.